Hi, folks. My name is Joe, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is for coming into the Middle South. It's March the 1st of 1949. I'm deeply, deeply grateful to come in third behind those two real heroes like Skinny and Eve. Let's give them another hand. I've got a lot of folks that have been just marvelous to me at this meeting. I've been to a few of them in my day, but never have I been in a place that like this, that there's just no way you can get away. They give you everything that you need, and Rusty, of course, was the guy who picked me up, and we weren't out of the airport. And Hoss appeared, and he was going up to Knoxville, and he promised us he'd be back by tomorrow, and he's already back. I don't know whether that says what that says about Knoxville, or whether his influence with Delta got him back so quickly. The people around here, Larry, we had a great sharing session this afternoon when we had a little lunch. I love Dooley's talk. It was basic AA, and that's where I come from. And Joanne, I've heard many, many great Al-Anon speakers, but I don't think I ever was as such or as feeling of real awe and wonder at that talk and the fact that she is who she is in life. Let's give her another hand. And, of course, I'm looking forward one day at a time to tomorrow morning when I can sit back with the troops where I'm most comfortable and hear the First Lady of AA in the South, Eve M., and we'll all have a great time then, too. I'm very grateful tonight. I feel very good. I'm a man who has a home group. My home group is the Skyland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta. It's almost a microcosm of Alcoholics Anonymous today. There's 250 members, and 175 of them are under 30. And there's about five of them like me who are approaching 100. And then there's a few other those they call middle-aged people. My group is so important. You see, because there's where I see the miracle and the magic of AA working. I see new people coming in, beaten and broken and alone in their own way, like I was. And I see them start to get sober. And I see them start to do a little service around the group. And then I see them go out and get a better job or a job if they don't have one. I don't see very much 13 stepping in that group, but I guess maybe I don't see everything. But in any case, then I see the shine in their eyes as they start to really get sober, and they get in the steps, and they start to change, and they start to become people who are really members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you, but that's the way I see my home group. I see this happening. I see AA working. And from my experience and opportunity of traveling a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous in the service structure, I really feel that AA is in great shape. I am not one of those who thinks that things aren't so good. I really think we are in magnificent shape, considering the fact that we may have as many as 3 or 4 million people going to meetings in 140 countries all over the world next week. My group is important to me. I have probably talked enough now for you to know that I was not born in Atlanta, Georgia.
I've been down here 40 years. I think I have a magnificent southern accent. The only problem is that I'm only the only person who thinks that way. I was born in Fall River, Massachusetts. It's often called the city of mills, hills, and pork pies. Of a great father who came over in a cattle boat from Ireland and became very successful, and from a most beautiful lady in the world, my mother. I was the oldest of six kids, and we were in very good financial position and had a beautiful home and all the things that we needed. Something happened when I was about 10 or 11 years old. I saw some of it. I saw a policeman coming into our beautiful home and forcibly taking my mother to a hospital with the disease of manic depressive psychosis. She was to spend most of the remaining 30 years in and out of hospitals. After I got sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I developed a magnificent rapport and relationship with her. I had no understanding of her sickness, of her illness. My reaction was something that I became very professional at a few years later. I tucked that information in my gut. I tried to be a good athlete. I tried to be a good student. I tried to make a lot of friends. I knew that people were saying things in those days about her being in the nut house. It hurt. And so I did all the things necessary at the age of 10 or 11 so that I would not have to look at that. And at 15, around a campfire in my native New England, I got an answer. Myself and three or four other guys, I was 15, they were 17, 18, and 19, went camping. Some wine was passed around. Lots of it. I got into it. I can remember like it was yesterday. That first drink was so nice and warm. And then it hit my head, and everything felt okay. I felt okay. I went on and drank, got drunk, blacked out, passed out, and although I had never drank before, I went looking for and found a drink in the morning to make me feel better. And that was my first reaction, my first experience with alcohol. And I drank like that for the next 12 years, only worse. They say that alcoholism is insidious and progressive. And I think whoever they are right. Because I was the last one almost to know what a hopeless and a helpless alcoholic I was. It was progressive. For instance, at 18, 3 years later, drinking all the time in between, of course. At 18, my second day at Harvard College, a freshman smoker, some booze was involved. I got into it, and before I blacked out or passed out, my newfound classmates carried me back to my room, put me up in the shower, and my reaction, which I certainly would not repeat here in the great state of Mississippi, or anywhere else in AA for that matter, but it all boiled down to I was no good. I was less than. And so at 18, my alcoholism was moving. I was an alcoholic and didn't know it. And neither did anybody else at that point in time. At 21, I came to my beloved Southland for the first time. A beautiful island off the coast of South Carolina. It was called Paris Island. Yeah, I was in the Second World War, and I was a member and a proud member of the United States Marine Corps. And I went through boot camp, and I stayed very sober. And you who have ever been through a boot camp know how much credit I deserve for that. The captain thought I was a man who had potential. Of course, I found out later as I got sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that all of us have potential as long as we're sober. But he thought I had potential. And I went through boot camp and became a DI under his command for several months, and he sent me up to Quantico to get a commission in the United States Marine Corps. So I would have the privilege of being up front and first as we went into combat. But that's no big deal. That's what it's all about. I loved the Marine Corps. I was ready to do anything I had to do. The American people were 100% in that for that war. Everybody was involved in it. And it's been a long time before another thing like that happened, such as Desert Storm. It's a 10-week deal, and about 8 weeks into it, I had it pretty well set. I wasn't leading the troops or anything like that, but I was up in the top 25% of our class, and I got a 72-hour pass. And I took that pass, and I went into Quantico, Virginia. Excuse me. I went from Quantico, Virginia into Washington, D.C. And I started drinking with three buddies. And I lost those three buddies. I was already very bad to drink with. And I woke up 73 hours after that pass was issued on a park bench in Washington. And the Marine Corps justice is swift and sure. And I was down to Camp Pendleton down here in North Carolina, Tent City, and then Camp Pendleton out in California, and into the 6th Marines out in the war. And I saw action in Saipan and Tinian and Okinawa. No big deal. I was busted. I realized as I got sober later on in life, I realized that I was truly powerless over alcohol. I went overseas, and I got back just about as the war was ending. The first bomb had already stopped, and I was ready to go home. Not quite. I was going to take a roundabout trip. I was in Mare Island in the Naval Hospital where I had sustained injuries. I would love to tell you about all the battles that I got those injuries in. But I will have to tell you the truth, and that is that I got those injuries in a barroom brawl overseas, and it also gave me a bad shoulder and so on and so forth. And so I was hanging around Mare Island for a couple of 3 months, and I was out drinking. I was getting locked up. I was automatically a guy that got locked up. I'd go before the captain's mass and my story, for fortunately, there were many captain's mass. And fortunately, my story stood. I told them all, one at a time, that what happened was that these swabbies, these Navy guys, were saying bad things about the Marine Corps, and Captain, I couldn't stand that. And he said, "You're right. Case dismissed." Eventually, I got discharged with an honorable discharge. You know how lucky some of us are. And I started home. I had plenty of money. I would be just calling from town to town that I needed a few more dollars. My dad was not wised up, nor was I, to the fact that I was a bad alcoholic already. He thought I was a young Marine sowing his wild oats. And he was willing to finance it. Eventually, 3 months later, I got home. And if every Marine looked as bad as I did, the parents in this country would have thought we had lost the war. Not won it. So, I went out and I took the geographical tour. I went out to a place in Kansas for an oil company after being booted out, and nicely, but being booted out of my family's business that would have taken care of me for the rest of my life. And I went to this town that had a very good reputation. I was given quite a send-off by the oil man who my father was able to get a hold of. I stayed at the rooming house. Wasn't quite like that. It was even better than a rooming house, that the mayor of that town and the chief of police, when they came to this town, lived in. There was a lady named Mamie who was the landlady there. And as I kept getting arrested, even though I played ball for the team, I kept getting arrested. She came to me one day and said, Joe, I'm going to have to pack you. You're going to have to go, or they're going to lock you up. So I took off. I got back east. I got married during this interim to a wife who is still my wife, who is the mother of our 5 children and the grandmother of our 10 grandchildren. And she is often a little nervous in places like this where I put it in that way. She says, what will those people ever think of me to marry somebody in your condition? I say, you know, our folks understand these things. There was no place for me to go. My dad finally got to a doctor who told him that he was enabling him. I was immediately thrown out of the house, nicely, but out. I got the right treatment. My dear wife did the same thing. She showed me the door, even though we had a little baby on the way. And so I had to go to the south end of Boston, which is the only place that guys like me went. I had, of course, used up all my contacts at Harvard, at Andover, guys I had met with in the Marine Corps. I was just all the way down to the end. I operated on the south end of Boston. I got very sick. I got very thin. I was very jiggy. I was very, very sick. And there was no question that if something hadn't happened, that my life was about either to be over or that I would join my mother in one of those institutions. And then something happened. Something that happens in this fellowship. Something, some miracle, and it's not too strong a word to use. Bouncing around the south end of Boston one day, I saw this fine-looking man on the corner. He was a guy that I had visited with, and he had been a fellow sufferer in one of the 11 drying-out places and hospitals and mental hospitals that I had gone to. And he was a fellow who was a periodic drunk. In those days, those guys drank hard for a couple of 3 weeks, and then they'd go to a drying out place and drink a little easier, and finally, 6 or 8 weeks later, they'd come back. These were guys who were in pretty good shape financially and could do that. This fella, Jim, was one of those, and I had been in the various hospital with him. And he spotted me, and he sniffed a little bit. I'd had a little formaldehyde that morning. That was one of the favorite drinks down there in Skid Row in those days, because we were able to get it through various maneuvers that went on. And he said, Joe, you don't look very good. Of course, I weighed then about 125 or 130 pounds. That particular day, I think I had a 3 or 4 day growth of beard on me. I was very shaky. I didn't look 26 years old or 27 years old. Instead, I looked considerably older. And I said, Jim, you're right, I don't feel too good. But I said, Jim, I need about $50. And I think I can do some things and get straightened out in the next couple of weeks. I hear a polite titter here and there, but I'll tell you, you were right. You were absolutely right. He looked at me and he said, Joe, you're not a $50 guy anymore. Take a buck and get yourself a shot in the nail because you look like you need it. And I took it. As I walked around the corner to take that buck and spend it in my favorite haunt in the south end of Boston, I started really to, I had looked at myself occasionally before, but I started to want to do something about my drinking. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, but it was even more than that. I could see my life running away. And I really didn't want that to happen. I had gone over the bay. About 2 days later, a kid brother, the only kid brother of my family who was living, I buried the middle three children in their 50s, people who had, two of them had a mental illness, and the third one had alcoholism and other problems. And this brother, Bill, picked me up. He was easy to find. I was well known at that point down there in the south end of Boston because I was also one of the younger people, the youngest person that I knew of in my condition down there. And Bill picked me up, and I said, I need a drink. And he said, we've got a half a pint. And we drove around the south end of Boston. And about 6 o'clock, he stopped the car in front of this building. And I vaguely remembered it. I was pretty loaded then between the formaldehyde and the bottle of booze. And in any case, it was the Washingtonian Hospital. Now, I had been in the Washingtonian and endured that aversion therapy treatment in which I almost died 2 years before. And I had told everybody in the south end of Boston what a bad deal it was. Don't go near it. The doctor had heard about my discussions and my needles, and I was barred from the Washingtonian. And yet on this night, 6 o'clock or so, my brother and I went into the Washingtonian. The doctor was not there. The young lady took his money. I finished up the half a pint, and to stand here in Jackson, Mississippi, and share with you that that is the last drink I have had for 43 and a half years is to understand a little of the awe and the miracle that I feel I received. I went down into the chute. The doctor came in the next day, very upset, but there's nothing he could do. I was full of formaldehyde. I had to undergo at least 3 or 4 days before I could be released. And sure enough, a couple of days later, I did go upstairs, very shaky, and I did get a phone call to use the phone. It was a locked place. That Washingtonian, by the way, was the last vestige of the Washingtonian movement that sobered up over 500,000 alcoholics 100 years before that. And I called my wife. And I don't know what I said, and she doesn't know. But before I called her that day, I walked that place all over. And I wanted to get sober in such a way that it was strong and it was firm and that I felt, regardless of what the outcome was, I wanted to get sober. I'm not going to explain how come I could suddenly come to something like that, but certainly it had to do with the experience as an alcoholic that I had had. She came in a couple of 3 days later. She was shocked. She hadn't seen me in months. I weighed, as I said, about 130. The only coat I had was a big coat, and it was far too big for me, or it had been okay originally, but of course I was weighing 130 pounds, and I was like a skeleton. I was jiggy, I was shaking. I got in the car. We didn't say very much. We drove about 25 miles to my wife's home, which later became our home, and in her car that later became our car. There was a man out near where Elaine and I lived named Arthur. Arthur D. Arthur D. was a tough guy. Arthur D. had gotten sober in 1939 when Patty Keegan brought AA to Boston. Arthur was one of those typical, tough Irishmen, and he was sober 10 years. We don't have them guys like him anymore. He was also running Boston's AA. Obviously, we have a very democratic organization in AA now. But in any case, Arthur came over. Elaine gave him a cup of coffee. And Arthur looked at me and he said, "Phelan, I hear you want to get sober." I said, Arthur, looking at him probably for the first time that I had looked at anyone, I said, "Yes, Arthur, I want to get sober." He says, "Well, kid, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to carry the message to you. I'm going to take you to the message." We got in the car, which he said very nicely, "Get in the car." And not a word was spoken as we drove 40 miles to Woburn, which is a suburb of Boston. We came to this fine-looking house, and two fine-looking men were standing outside the side where they had the meetings, underneath in the basement. One of them was Dr. F. Dr. F. was the founder of the Woburn Group. And next to him was another fine-looking man. Arthur and I appeared before them, and Arthur said, "Here he is." And Dr. F. said, "Joe, we've been waiting to see you." You see, in those days, everybody knew who was drunk. And everybody knew who was sober. And there were little bands all over. They knew my whole story. And so Dr. F. said, "Joe, I'm glad to see you. You can come on in." He said, "But there's one other thing, Joe." He said, "This man is Hunt." Hunt happened to be a dentist himself, Dr. Hunt C. He says, "Joe, Hunt is your sponsor." I was not allowed in the place without a sponsor. And he was a beautiful man. For 4 years, he was my sponsor up there. He saved my life. He brought me along back into sanity as I started to get sober. And yet, if you would call his wife, and Hunt has been gone now about 10 years, and we've stayed close together. I went back to see him year after year. If you would call his wife, as people have, and asked her what was the relationship between Joe and Hunt, she says Joe saved Hunt's life. And of course, what happened was, as I got sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took a while to get anywhere near well, even physically, I started to have confidence. I started to have joy. I started to feel that this was a great thing, and I started to feel and act like it was the right thing, and it was the thing that I was going to do. And it sort of livened him up. My trip the first 4 years started off a little rocky. I didn't drink. I lived under the most protective venue you could possibly imagine. I had a little job in the town of Acton, which is outside of Boston. My job was to work for the town out in the woods cutting trees and raking leaves. My wife would take me out there to work at 8 o'clock with a little bag of sandwiches and would come pick me up at 5 o'clock. Hunt would come at 6 or 6:30 and we would go to a meeting. One day, about two months into this, it wasn't really sobriety. I was not drinking. I told Hunt that I felt jiggy. And that's a New England word for getting ready to break out, getting ready to drink. And I said, I just can't understand it. I don't, but I told him. And he didn't say anything, and we went up down to the meeting, and then he left. And when the meeting started, the young drunk Joe was the subject of the meeting. They wanted to know how come I felt jiggy after 2 months. They wanted to know how come I thought I was ready to drink. And as the conversation went around, and some of it was not very kind, one guy finally hit on it. He said, Joe, you tell us what the problem is. And I said, well, I must be one of those 90-day wonders. Not being a wise guy, I must be a 90-day wonder. And then it dawned on them. They said, Joe, we stay sober one day at a time. And I had heard that at least a couple of hundred times. But I was afflicted also with the disease of thinking and not hearing. Selective hearing, I call it. I heard what I wanted to hear, and I don't know why I didn't want to hear that. But I heard it that night. And my life changed from that day on. I was so excited that I had Hunt into the house when we came back from the meeting and made some coffee, because I had a feeling, more than that, that I could stay sober one day at a time with these guys. And the next day, when I was out in the woods, I got another feeling that I could stay sober one day at a time. It was a big deal for me. I took an early first, second, third, fourth, and fifth steps in the first few months, in the first year. I remember that first, fourth, and fifth step I took. The fourth I took, I didn't have much trouble taking it because I had been to so many hospitals, 10 or 11, that I knew how you do that, because at hospitals, when you came in, they asked you all these questions. So it certainly helped me. And I went to a beautiful fella for my first fifth step. And it went on for about 3 hours, and I got it all out. And then I said to him, boy, that was really something. He says, you ought to get on your knees and thank God that you were willing to do this. So already I had still had plenty of ego. It was starting to come back. And there was no question that but it did help me. It did help me. About a year into my sobriety, I decided that I wanted to get back in the finance business where I had been for a while and liked. And I went into Boston for the first time since I got sober. And I got into this office and I talked with this man, the manager of a company that had offices all over the country in the finance business. And he said, Joe, this resume looks a little thin. And I then told him the entire story. And he said, Joe, I can buy this. I'm going to take a chance on you. And so I went to work. And then about 2 months later, as I called in one day, he said, Joe, I want you to come into the office. He said, Mr. Chaplin is in here. Well, Mr. Chaplin was the president of the company. And he was checking the Boston office, but he had something else on his mind. He wanted to talk to me. Good about it. I have no fears about it. I was starting to feel pretty good, and then in my second year in sobriety, and I came in, and he sat down, and he said, I came down here, Joe, to fire you. I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, we have a bonding company that has to bond all our personnel. The bonding company has made a report on you, as they do on everybody. They find 50 or 60 arrests over the United States alone over the last 5 or 10 years. Now, they don't find anything except disorderly conduct, creating a disturbance, having a fight. There's nothing about stealing money, but they're afraid the next thing might be that might happen. And so they won't bond you. I said, well, I know I did discuss this with Mr. Hayden, my manager. He said, I know you did. And you've discussed it with me, and you've told me. And he says, we're going to take a chance on you. See, I already had 2 or 3 kids. We had them like raindrops. They came rolling in as I got sober. My poor mother-in-law used to say, my God, what is going to happen to this guy? And what's going to happen to my daughter? This guy's having kids every week. But in any case, that worked out. And so there was no question that as I walked out of that office, I bawled like a baby because I wanted that job. That job meant an opening for me. That job meant in a good company another chance to really start to reestablish myself. And I was very grateful. He became a lifelong friend, both the manager and the president of the company to me. Later on, many years later, when I had my own finance company of over 40 offices and 500 employees, I used to see him at meetings, and I would ask, say, Jack, has anybody else ever told you another story? Yes. We were good friends, and that was a very big turning point for me. I did some more of the steps, but I stayed within the first 5, the first 3 or 4 years. And then my boss at the office came to Georgia, and he was going to run the whole state, and they had many units in Georgia and some in other southeastern states. And the minute he got the job, the promotion, he called me, and he said, I'm going to give you an office down in Atlanta. So my 4 years into my sobriety, we came to Atlanta. And I looked around the AA at that time. I had to stay sober. I didn't have any connection. I didn't know how to call New York and find out somebody down there. And I checked around, and I decided I'm going to look at all the meetings. They only had about 4 or 5 meetings in Greater Atlanta 40 years ago. And I went to them all. And I didn't like some of the things I saw. They didn't use the big book in Atlanta. There was no big book around. Nobody was talking about a big book. So obviously I made the classic mistake that us Yankees make when we come to the South. Instead of keeping my mouth shut, I blew it. Fortunately, there was a lady named Neely, and Neely D., who Eve knew well, the first lady of AA in Georgia, and she took up my position. And she told the other people in the groups, I'll take care of Joe and we'll get him smoothed out eventually to be a good Southern AA. And I don't know if I've got that far yet, but that saved me, and I started to look at my family. We already had 4 kids. I was sober 4 years. I had picked one up earlier than that. And I needed to be ambitious. I was cleared up pretty well mentally and emotionally. I had a life now. I had a lovely wife and great kids, and I loved babies. And I worked hard. And I went to lots of meetings, and I carried the message, and then I got another big break. A fellow named Johnny S., who was 12-step by Dr. Bob, started to come into Atlanta on a regular basis from Alabama. I had known him briefly in New Bedford, and he was with Goodyear, and he was down in Alabama, and he came over to Atlanta because he had a daughter with two or three of his grandkids there, so I saw him all the time. This was a beautiful man. This was a man with pure humility. This was a man who was more than just a pigeon of Dr. Bob's. He was a disciple of Dr. Bob's, and yet he was calm. He was cool. I used to ask him about Bob, and he would tell me. And his insights into me as an alcoholic were tremendous. We finally buried him 30 years later. And for several years, a couple anyway, the first time in my career in AA, I didn't have a sponsor. I lived on what I knew Johnny would tell me on any kind of an issue. I corrected that now, and I do have another sponsor, but it's on a little different basis, and I'm still calling on Johnny's wisdom for some of the decisions that I have to make. I dug harder into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really started to use them over the next 5 or 10 years as the base of my recovery. Things like, if things went wrong, or I was bad with somebody, or I had an argument, I would sit quietly and go over the steps and realize the third step, I'm breaking it all the time. I'm turning my life over to God at 7 o'clock, and at 7:30 I'm taking it back, and I can't run my life any better today. 43 years into this recovery by myself, on my own way, than I ever could. And I had to learn that, in many ways, the hard way. I began to try to build a relationship with a God of my own understanding. My first God was my sponsor, and my second God was my home group. And then I began to call this power God. But I had to work at it. Today, it isn't a question of what God is for me. I know, as I stand here tonight, I know that God understands me. I don't have to understand him. I know he is there, everywhere. Meanwhile, the children were being educated and going to college, and everybody started to leave the house at 25 years of sobriety. Elaine, who was a tremendous mother and still is, a great lady. Many of you have met her. She is a marvelous, marvelous person. But she had to live with a tough alcoholic in recovery for a long time during that first 25 years. We looked at each other as the kids left the nest. And we said, we even thought of breaking up. A lot of our friends, not necessarily alcoholics, were doing that at the 25-year mark for some reason. Thank God we decided not to. She went into Al-Anon, and it wasn't an answer. She made the decision. And she tells me that her Al-Anon has really helped her. It's given her an ability, she says, to truly be herself. She really felt at many times, of course, living with me, but in other areas, that she did need some strengthening, some raising her self-esteem. I kept working on God as I understand him, as well as my business. And I went out to California on a business trip, and I had a meeting with Chuck C. I had known Chuck many years before. And Ely was a great friend of Chuck's, and so I knew Chuck. And I knew that Chuck had something special. He'd done a lot of work and spiritual affairs in Alcoholics Anonymous and in other areas too. So I went out there and I sat with Chuck, and we sat in that beautiful living room right by the Pacific Ocean, and the window with the ocean on it, and the little town of Laguna Beach, and the sand. He says there's always a little sand in everybody's life. And we talked about God for about 3 hours. Chuck talked about God 2 hours and 50 minutes. I went along for about 10 minutes. But that was the way I wanted it. I wanted to hear, and I started to get some strength. That night we went to dinner and we went to a meeting. And the next day I went to my appointments in Los Angeles on Friday, and then Saturday morning as I got ready to go, I felt different. I felt different. I felt now I had something here that could develop. And it's something that has developed for me. It has developed for the simple, simple plan. The simple truism that God understands me. And all I have to do is, as Chuck would say, do his business, and then he'll take care of my business. And it was really a thrill for me. As I came home, going about 20,000 feet above the 30,000 we were flying, I was really happy. I got into the house, and Elaine thought that it was like that day when I found out all you had to do was stay sober one day at a time. She said, "Fine, Joe, sit down." She gave me some coffee, and she said, "Joe, it sounds good, but now you gotta live it." And I have tried to do that in the last 15 years of my recovery. My first 25 years in AA was great. It was marvelous. But my last 15 have been much more special. Within a month of this time, 25 years into AA, I was at a home group, the steering committee meeting. And they were selecting candidates for their various jobs for that year. And they said, "Joe, why don't you become the GSI?" My time was open. I had more time. Things were coming together. And I did that job. And then I did all the jobs that were offered to me. I believe in service. I spent almost 20 years in service. I became the DCM and the delegate and the chairman and chairman of the office committee. And then in April of 1985, I was elected for the first trustee from the state of Georgia. And I have been given the whole world by this fellowship. And to realize that is to realize my happiness, my joy, my confidence, my gratitude, and I do know, very simply, I haven't done it at all. I have showed up, and these things have happened. I wouldn't want you to think, as we go out to dance tonight, I wouldn't want you to think that my life has been nothing but a bowl of cherries. It sure sounds like it. I know about pain. I've had a lot of pain since getting sober. I think the most toughest kind of pain for me to deal with is the pain that comes from me being less than myself, less than I can be. But even for that kind of pain, there is forgiveness. I've had the pain of burying my mother and father, burying 3 younger brothers, bringing a boy, the youngest brother, to our home 25 years before he died, and taking care of him for 25 years, not in the house, but in Atlanta, in good quarters. it was really a shocker for me when I got the word that he had dropped dead from a heart attack. He was my youngest brother. We used to call him Boo. He knew all the kids. They loved him. He was a schizophrenic. He's a very sick guy, but he was not dangerous. He was almost cute. And when he died suddenly, it really hit me strong. We had a little meeting service in Atlanta, and then I took him back to his father, and we buried him in Massachusetts. And I kept crying and breaking up, and I had been through this 4 or 5 times before. And when during the middle of the Mass for him in Massachusetts, I got a little feeling, and that feeling was, Joe, you don't have to cry anymore. Robert is with me, and you are in difficulty with it because he really, in your view, is another one of your children. He came down when he was 25, and he was helpless as a babe. But to have that kind of an experience coming from where I came from is to recognize, for me anywhere, the quiet power and glory of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love serving on the board, and I was in Mississippi a couple of times during my tour. I just think that doing that job is really something special. For there's no question that it is important, but it's also more no question that we are all in this together. And there are no bosses in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mentioned briefly forgiveness. Forgiveness has been very, very important to me. Extremely so. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I needed forgiveness tremendously. When I made that first, fourth, and fifth step, I saw what it was like. When I made several others over the first 15 years, and I received forgiveness, I am well satisfied from my recognition of my higher power that I have received it. And I have done, because of this program and because of the development that can take place, I have done a lot of forgiving myself. But most importantly of all, coming at the end of receiving it, of giving it, is understanding and accepting forgiveness. And I consider it one of the most important parts of my life and of my recovery. Tonight, here in this old-timers meeting, we have a few old-timers. I got to think of the oldest timers of them all, Bill and Bob. Unlike Eve, I never knew Bill. And I never knew Bob, but I knew them both. When I was a kid, in a hospital, Blythewood, to be exact, run by Dr. Tebow, 45 years ago, we were taken to a meeting on Long Island. In one of those jitneys, we went into a hall about the size of this on Long Island, and there was an AA meeting about to start. Now, in those days, I was not sober, and I had many things on my mind, such as how am I going to get out of this place, what am I going to do for money, and the various other things. And so I paid no attention to this tall, thin man as he talked like I am sharing tonight, until the very end. And somebody often asks him, what do I want for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous? And Bill, who it was, Bill W., raised his hand to the sky and he said, a long line of my fellows and sisters going back to the Father. I know Bill Wilson. I know of the tremendous work that I saw when I was in New York, that it's still there, it's still working, it still continues to work. An unbelievable human being, a gift, I am sure of my own, in my own heart, a gift of my higher power. And I know Bob. I never met Bob. I've made a pilgrimage to Akron 8 or 10 years ago. But I learned a lot about Bob from my sponsor, Johnny. Bob was truly a humble man. And he was, if the truth were known, my hero in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because humility, in many ways, is still continuing to elude me on a regular basis. What did Bob say? Bob said, it all boils down to love and service. And we know what love is, at least after being in AA a while we do. And we know what service is. What did Bill say when he left us? Did he have any great statement to make? He said no. He said, thank you for your lives. This magnificent person who gave us the life that we have today said, thank you for your lives. In closing, I'd like to share with you my favorite AA story. It came when I was a young kid in the fellowship, hanging on by my fingernails for sobriety, knowing that if I slipped, I was gone, not wanting to be gone. And this guy tells this story. It's about the sick drunk down in an alleyway next to a drugstore in a little town in Massachusetts. He's beaten, he's broken, he's alone, he's got the DTs, and he's about to go into the Horrors. And so nothing he can do to get a drink. It's about 9 o'clock. The place is going to close. He couldn't do anything. I know what kind of shape he was in. I was. And sure enough, a guy comes around the corner, goes in, gets a half a pint. This guy was a member of the local AA group. He knew this guy. The guy knew him. He goes down the alleyway, and in those days, we were doctors, too, you know. You don't know what this guy had, but he had the half pint. He brings it to him. And then his higher power told him something else, I think. He said, Johnny, why don't you come home with me, too? We'll get a bath, get you a bath, get you some soup. You got this quarter half pint, and maybe tomorrow we can get together and get going again and get sober. The sick drunk, shocked, just uttering from the very guts of him. God is good, he says. God is good. And here tonight in Jackson, God is good. He's been very good to me, a sick drunk. And may he be very good to you. God bless you all.